Welcome today to an interview series with Outstanding Professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Richard Longworth, leading award-winning international technology authority, thought leader, educator, and celebrated author. Richard, you have a lifetime of outstanding contributions in a number of fields. Thank you for coming in today to do this interview.
And thank you very much, Stephen. It is indeed a pleasure to be with you today and with your audience, and I certainly look forward to today's interview. Thank you.
Richard, what sparked your initial interest in computers?
Well, as I think back, Stephen, it was more coincidental than planned. This goes back to the early 70s, and after I graduated from Concordia University with a degree in mathematics, I was asked to join Pratt & Whitney Aircraft in Montreal. My future supervisor at that time explained that mathematics was a precursor into data processing. So I would be a natural at working in those days. It was data processing. Computers were relatively new, and business computers were applied, but it was just the beginning. And with no formal background in computers, I joined the programming department. In those days, of course, scientific programming, particularly with the engineering department at Pratt & Whitney, was the in thing. So I started off as a programmer in Fortran, and I did, because of my background, some math modeling for the engineering department. And not exciting, but certainly more of a coincidence than planned.
So did you study Fortran at all when you were at university, or did you just learn that yourself?
Actually, no. I took no computer or data processing courses at all. Again, my mathematics seems to be my in, and of course in the 70s, data processing was quite a hot topic. So no, I had no formal training in Fortran at all, Stephen.
So that would be an interesting time, learning the language and then starting to program.
My gosh, yes, yes. Of course, the excitement at that time was that as long as you were a hot body, as long as you had a degree, jobs were quite, there was quite a lot of jobs, and particularly in the data processing field. It was sort of a gift to me at that time, and I'm sure today it doesn't come quite as easy when going through interviews and when looking for a new career.
So how did you get into teaching?
The days I started teaching dates back to also the 1970s. I worked at Pratt & Whitney Aircraft for, 4 years, and I always had an interest in teaching, and particularly with young people. I worked with youth groups at the church I belonged to, and I really dearly wanted to get into teaching. And the opportunity arose in a place called Chomedey in Quebec. And I went into high school teaching at the time, and because of working 3 or 4 years at Pratt & Whitney, they had me do courses in data processing, and that dates back to 1973-74. However, I only stayed at Chomedey Polyvalent for 1 year, and the truth of the matter is I didn't particularly enjoy the year I had there. It was a difficult time. The students were hard and difficult, grade 11, grade 12, and at that point I only lasted 1 year, went back to Pratt & Whitney for another 3 or 4 years. But my teaching career really in the Pacific Northwest started in 1983 when I joined, at the time, of course, the school system. Capilano College is a school in North Vancouver. And from 1983 until my retirement, I stayed at Capilano College.
How would you describe your top innovative achievements in terms of the problems you were trying to solve, your solutions, and the impact it has today and into the future?
Very good question, Stephen. And of course, you know me somewhat, and it's always been important to me as a problem solver. Some of my work that I did in Vancouver was as a systems analyst with the TELUS Corporation. And it was sort of the systems field being sort of problem solvers. And I've always been struck by Robert Kennedy's words. If you remember those, they are those who look at things the way they are, and that's why. I dream of things that never were, and that's why not. And I'll always remember those words. They're important to me at the time, and they're still very important to me. I derive a lot of pleasure working on problems. And when interested, all problems, of course, but the ones that interest me, I'd like to wrestle them to the ground and come up with a solution. For me, it's really not unlike solving the math problems, the problems that I had when I was at university at Concordia. For example, 10 years ago, my wife taught grade 4 at the time and asked me how she could make the internet easier for her students and the selection of content at some sort of an appropriate reading level. That is, Stephen, of course, when the students access the internet, a lot of the research, a lot of the material was not at that grade 4 level, as is the case with many students who are using computers. Now, the answer was really the answer I came up with was to leverage the mass of information on the internet in order to create a knowledge framework. And this solution was really a personalized service, and it was a framework around XML, DOM, and RDF. We called it at the time the Learning Knowledge Framework, LKF was the acronym. And I really do like to think of LKF as a predecessor of Web 2, and particularly folksonomy and information sharing and collaboration. Now, that is a solution to that one problem, and it did have an impact with the idea that I came up with. I was able to go to a World Congress in Montreal and present my findings. Now, there's many other examples, but perhaps if you allow me, as I think through, I'd like to select one more, particularly since this interview is about, in my view, technology and the work that I'm doing at the present time. Now, a few years ago, I was asked by some of my students at Capilano College, now it's Capilano University, to identify my teaching style. Now, they argued that they found it different and engaging, and I'll go with that. But under the constraints of full-time teaching load, I wrote a brief article and posted it on, in those days, Course Manager. And it was titled Awakening Intelligence. Nothing to do really with technology, more to do with the intelligence rather than the intellect. Now, with that, we had many discussions on the article, and it channeled further into a deeper discussion on life issues focused around education and philosophy, psychology, and spirituality. Last year, this was my first year of retirement, I wrote a book based on some of these discussions, and the book was published in January 2009 and has the title, Turning the Self Inside Out. It's directed primarily at college students, but it does have a universal appeal and covers a wide range of contemporary issues. The book analyzes thinking processes and directs us towards a more purposeful way of thinking, and I do believe that we are at a turning point when there's an urgent need for change. And I'll go, I guess, with Obama's word, the time is now for changes. Changes have got to occur. Now, in the past, we took the time and invested financial resources to cope and make these necessary changes. But today, I really believe we have little time and fewer financial resources to make these changes. And I propose through my book and through the solution that what we need to do is re-engineer our thinking in order to solve these problems. And hopefully, as this interview goes along, we can elicit some of those ways and some of the re-engineering thought processes that I have in mind.
So your book is your passion at the moment.
It certainly is, Stephen, and it's a switch. I really believe I am using the technology extensively, and I have that in the background. But I have a belief and a passionate way about thinking of that the future is in the hands of leaders of tomorrow. And I'd like to perhaps pursue the idea that I have something to offer, something to suggest for our future leaders of tomorrow.
So where is the book available?
The book is available through certainly Amazon. You can access it that way. I do have a means of ordering it directly on my website, and my website is www.rlongworth.com. And on the website, you will find not only information about the book, but also some of my current writings. And I have reflection pages. I have daily reading pages. And it's based on, at the moment, one of the articles I have up there is on education. And some of the future articles will be on technology and society. But even things, of course, which is dear to my heart, is our thinking process, our thoughts, fear, death, life issues, contemporary life issues.
You know, we live in an increasingly complex environment. So within that environment, how do you manage change? And then also, how do you make connections?
Very, very good, yeah. So certainly, let me just think. Maybe I could break that down into two parts. Now, the first part how do I manage change? And I'd like to just follow that question thoughtfully and carefully and maybe make some clarity. And I presume, of course, with your question, Stephen, that you're not asking how do I manage change, for example, going from my summer to my winter clothes, but a significant change, such as loss of a dear friend, retirement perhaps, as in my case, perhaps a career change, but more so, more purposeful perhaps, so our audiences maybe a shift in technology. I noticed also, though, too, that the operative word is do, and my short answer to that question, and it's often been posed to me that sort of question, but in different ways, but my short answer is I do really very little, but I realize, of course, this is not very useful. So let me take a specific example and maybe more be more helpful. Say this change in technology. Now, suppose the individual that we're speaking to has worked with a piece of software for the last 10 years, and you, the person, are considered the expert. Suddenly, the organization decides to procure a more up-to-date new piece of software from a different vendor. Wow, what a change. And this conjures up all sorts of reactions, and I would think in the individual mostly quite negative. For example, why are they doing this to me? The nerve of them. How am I going to cope? How am I going to handle this? I was quite an expert in the other piece of software. Now, all of these sort of have a negative type of connotation. And once these reactions are sort of hardwired into our psyche, it becomes even more difficult to adapt and cope. So with any change, any significant change of momentum, I myself try to watch in my mind's eye, so to speak, my reaction to a change. And I observe my feelings, my thoughts. And instead of engaging in a typical unconscious knee-jerk reaction, I thoughtfully think through it. And this is part of my change in, of course, thinking process. In most cases, by simply observing my reaction towards a change, I then become sort of fully aware of my feelings and my thoughts about it. And through this observation, I'm able to make a conscious decision without becoming emotionally attached. By so doing, Stephen, I truly achieve some sort of a transformation. I believe that it rewires my thinking process and allows me to adapt and cope with new situations. And it certainly paved the way to a better life for me, a more coping. I accept challenges. Changes to me are just a challenge, an opportunity. Now, your second question, how do I make connections? And it is important to me in my work because I realize I spent most of my life in technology. And again, I feel this is a gift that I can rely on. And I rely on it even more than ever before. I have regular emails. I have now accounts in Twitter and Facebook and LinkedIn and Blogger and Meeting Up and Second Life. And a lot of these are new to me. I use RSS feeds. I like Delicious. And I have a couple of favorite portals I visit regularly. My research is all done online, mostly online, and very rarely do I have to go and pick out books. I particularly like eZine articles online. Now, for most people, I suppose non-technology people, it could be imposing. But with my background in computers, the task is really not onerous. Each morning I check my accounts. I respond to any queries, review my feeds, and start my research. And then during the day, I periodically change for any new messages that have come. We truly, really do live in this global village where, you know, distance is a bridge through the Internet. So any meetings and researches are conducted online with the convenience of my home and office where I am most of the time now rather than going to work. But what would be without face-to-face contacts? I still really, really believe in that. My virtual world, as it implies, doesn't really rely on the physical content, and to me, this is important. I still receive more satisfaction and understanding and awareness, I suppose, humanness, when I talk directly face-to-face with a person. This is sort of the soul and heart of which makes me feel genuinely connected to people. And I think it's important, of course, as we look at information technology and as people look at new careers, that this face-to-face is an important component. Now, does that sort of answer the questions and the change in connection, Stephen?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And you're providing mechanisms of how it sort of impacts you and how you go forward.
Excellent. Excellent.
If you could sum up your life experience with career tips for the IT professional, what would be your tips and the reasons behind them?
And I'll do this seriously because this is important to me, whether working with church youth groups, whether working with new people who are entering college and or a new career. It is extremely important, of course, that I feel I have a moral and a sort of responsibility with my background to perhaps give some tips for future professionals, future leaders of tomorrow. So your question is very, very apt. Now, I really believe a career is just one, albeit a major part of your life, but it's so important that each part of our life be well balanced. We really, really do need to understand if we have an unhappy relationship, for example, it affects the whole, even your career. I'm sure we all feel this, but your attitude is a major consideration. You need to be upbeat, you need to be helpful and understanding, and a positive attitude is derived from a well-balanced lifestyle. I don't think you can sort of, through your thought processes, all of a sudden decide I'm going to be upbeat or helpful or understanding. It's sort of a holistic aspect. So I would suggest choose your career well, make it a free choice, something that you would really love to do the rest of your working life, and if it's not, work towards it. I always advise some of these students, I hate my job, I don't like my job. My gosh, you know, we live in North America, and the opportunities are galore. Change your job. Find a career that brings satisfaction, much satisfaction and joy. But also balance, this idea of balance, the career with good relationship and helpful living is important. Get in touch with your feelings and your thoughts, and that's part of my seminars and sessions I do now. Be flexible and spontaneous. And as events happen in the day, be willing and agreeable when appropriate. That's not to say that you're always a yes person, but give due consideration to what is asked of you and respect others. And, this goes with your boss and any relationships that you have. And be transparent. Communicate honestly and openly. Be willing to give each person that you speak with during the day your full and undivided attention. Just too often, of course, we're listening, half listening to people. And this is a common nature with most individuals. I would suggest being kind to yourself. Rest, relax, try meditation, yoga. Do at least one good deed a day. This is the holistic, the balance that you're trying to acquire. Be attuned to the universe and not just your work. There's more things going on than just your work. I really think, as I now at my age, as I look through, that there's really only three problems, major problems that you face. It's money and health and relationships. And the other problems are just manifestations of these three, Stephen. It's therefore important, I think, for the IT professional to make conscious decisions related to these problem areas. And again, ensure that the balance in your life is read and relax and find time for yourself, understand and manage your money, build strong relationships, exercise, eat healthy meals, and so important, make a habit of doing volunteer work. Do all these things and live life with passion. And you'll find that you'll make an immeasurable impact on the world. And I have nothing more, perhaps, to add other than I wish all the future ICT professionals the best wishes and the best of luck. And hopefully they will find a career, as I did, that they just love and a passion that they can follow for the rest of their life.
Now, you know, you've been around and engaged in the marketplace and in technology and in teaching and in research and so on. So you're really perfectly positioned. So can you make your predictions for the future, their implications, how business executives and IT professionals can best prepare?
Yes, of course, always a difficult question, making predictions, and maybe a bit of a disclaimer, Steve. You know, since my retirement, I have a much narrow focus on technology. I'm geared in one particular area. I think the depth now of the specific subjects of interest is increasing, but I'm exposed really to fewer and fewer areas. As I said, a disclaimer, we all agree that, you know, making future predictions is a perilous occupation and fearful sometimes when people ask me these sorts of questions, because it's much like the stock market. There's so many contradictory predictions and many of which never come true. I really think in the future it's going to be even more difficult for industry to make accurate predictions, and it's just the speed of change. We live in a global village and an unknown future, and events somewhere in the world could affect your business tremendously. But maybe at the very least, from what you're asking me, we can make a sort of a best guess of the future from the vantage point of the expertise that I might possess that you suggested. Now, I'm going to restrict perhaps some of my thinking to, you know, education and technology. global consciousness and something called quantum physics is the areas I've been interested in for the last 2 or 3 years. And maybe just try and, you know, identify some future trends. I really believe myself that the future of text, we're going to have hierarchical views of text and graphics for drilling down to, you know, different layers of it. And instead of, you know, the traditional linear approach with a single unified structure, more of a horizontal structure. Now, to me, and it has become important, and I see the impact that it's having on that society, is social network. And I foresee social network learning with digital textbooks and the proliferation of e-books such as Kindle and Sony Reader as sort of a future that's going to expand even more. Another point is emphasizing the advances in the behavioral social networking. I'm doing work at the moment in doing sampling and studies, particularly with Twitter, and trying to come up with this insight into people's practices and interactions. And I see things like, for example, social networking in Twitter as a great potential in the social behavioral area. Now, emerging technologies in creating and sharing research around content has become extremely important. I see that expanding, such as blogs and wikis and portals. A shift, perhaps, in scientific and educational movement. I see educational philosophy now from a more epistemology aspect. The knowledge aspect is moved from there to more of an ontology, a being aspect. So the person, the individual person, becomes more important than perhaps just the knowledge. And it's starting, and I see a shift in that sort of scientific and educational philosophy. I think also there's a movement more towards awareness-based content. I really, really like this because awareness is an important aspect of what I'm studying at the moment. So things like Twitter and microblogging and RSS, as compared to like an old paradigm of memory-based type of content. So we've moved away from enterprise and record and document management. Those were my days. I believe now the young generation, the future generation, is definitely going to be more in you know, an awareness-based content, such again as Twitter. Now, the implications of these predictions, well, I think information and access, knowledge, acquisition that was in the past is growing at sort of an explosive rate. And I fear sometimes that we seem to believe that we need more of the same. But my reality is that we face economic crisis, our planet is hurting, even our individual purpose is being questioned. So I really would argue that instead of chasing growth in companies, access makes perhaps in our closets, perhaps we should engineer our thinking for the future. And here's a few examples I'd like to propose, and I propose to some of my seminars. Now, business executives really need to question the intent of future technologies. I have a question that I'd love to ask the IT professional and the executives and the people who perhaps are making the decision. What is the problem to which a specific technology is a solution? I argue that in the past, the technology did really provide a solution to a problem, but I'm rather worried now that technology is just for technology's sake, and maybe there's some other hidden agenda than providing a solution. I'm a solution-oriented person, and I really enjoy asking that question. What is the problem to which a specific technology is a solution? And if the technology really doesn't provide a value answer, we need to analyze its purpose further. I would argue this. IT professionals and other workers, too, need to spend more time discovering who they are, and not as much on what they do. So we might consider being far more intentional about what we want to do. So going back to one of the other questions is, you know, what sort of a career? How can I choose my career? I think you really have to find out who you are and really what you want to do, rather than just chasing something for either the money situation, or because of the glory, or because of the glitz. You really have to identify who you are. And I think this is a trend to the future and something that should be well considered. Now, I've gone into some detail on that, but hopefully it does answer the question.
So going on to that then, going further, what do you see as the top three challenges facing us today, and how do you propose they be solved?
Okay, so let me just identify three that come to my mind. Well, the economy right now, of course, is in dire straits, world hunger, and terrorism. Well, Really, Stephen, I could identify others, and these are only three that I would consider the top challenges at the moment facing us today. Now, ask me on another day, and I may give you a different list of those three choices. And I believe it's because on a daily basis, crises arise, and the list is expanding and changing. I can discuss how to solve these three challenges, but to begin with, I really would suggest that we recognize, regardless of what challenge we face, that they are all symptoms of a human condition. Well, let me just expand on that. To meet and successfully solve these challenges, i.e. economy, world hunger, and terrorism, we must really identify and understand the cause. Every challenge has some sort of a root cause for us to probe. Now, I suppose this is going back to my systems analysis days when I was trying to solve a problem. I tried to initially try and look at the root cause, and I believe we should get back to that, use a systems approach. We really need to understand what underlies the challenge. Then we must, in every instance, ask why the challenge exists. Could it be perhaps greed or apathy or lack of understanding? And I would call these the root cause. The answers to why questions, you know, why do we have world hunger? Why do we have terrorism? I believe in identifying and analyzing a root cause. It's essential, really, in a step in solving the challenges. Perhaps a lot of companies, a lot of businesses do this, and perhaps a lot of politicians do this, but I fear that we just sort of throw money at things, such as the economy. We try and solve things like world hunger and terrorism by taking perhaps appropriate steps. But these, you know, world hunger, economy, and terrorism are just outcomes of an essential problem, a root problem. And that problem we really have to understand. And it could be, you know, a lack of understanding of other nations. It could be through greed or apathy that we have these problems. And only then I really believe that we can sort of proceed towards a realistic solution.
You know, during your working career, you were a college professor teaching courses in IT. Now as a retiree, you're working, writing, promoting global consciousness and awareness. Why such transformation?
Well, yeah, it certainly does appear as if it's a digression, a transformation. But in actual fact, in myself, Stephen, it isn't. My interest really in conscious awareness started some 30 years ago. I studied and always was interested in Jiddu Krishnamurti, who was a world leader and was really for 70 years of his life. He died in his 90s. So I look at my recent writings and presentations as not really a transformation, but more of an evolvement. I learned through my readings of Krishnamurti and others that mindfulness, as compared to mindless thinking, encourages an awareness around us. When we pay attention, we gain a greater sense of connection and a feeling of well-being. Of course, now that I'm retired, I can devote many, many, many hours to this mindfulness process. And I realize it's much harder when one is involved in the commitment of daily living. You know, time becomes an issue. Something that never seems, you know, people, particularly my daughter at the moment, who's in her late 20s, it never seems to be enough time in a day. But the secret really is making time for the self and taking time to practice mindfulness. And again, this is part of my change agent, my changing that's occurred. Do I believe it's important? Well, believe me, I believe it's the most important thing that we can do for ourselves. Just a few minutes of practice each day will have a remarkable impact on our life. I'm still evolving, I believe, in this mindfulness aspect, but I look back, it seems to be more purposeful, more healthy, more balanced, and more useful. You know, after all, mindfulness is really about gaining a true perspective on life, and I believe this is all really what we want.
So, you know, people will ask, mindfulness, really, what does that mean? Like, what is in your mind when you're in this sort of state of mindfulness?
It's certainly mindfulness and conscious awareness is almost the same sort of thing. Are you consciously aware of what's happening in your mind? I always find it interesting then when I sort of with my third eye listen to what's going on in my mind, and all of a sudden I realize I'm not paying attention to the other person. I'm off in another planet. I'm off on another tangent. Gee, I'm listening to the speaker at a seminar, and I'm thinking about my holidays. Most people are not mindful that that is really happening. And it's removing you from communication, connectedness, humanness, all the good things that life has to offer. We lose ourselves in our mind. And this is unconscious behavior, and mindless thinking. Does that sort of clarify it a bit, Steve?
I see. So you're sort of contrasting a mindless thinking versus mindfulness. So
that's right.
So in mindfulness, you're really saying paying attention to the things that are happening around you and give it your full attention, whatever that, you know, including the thoughts that are in your head, so that you'll know if you're becoming distracted at some time.
Exactly. You've got it. Now, there are 60,000 thoughts that pass through our mind every day. Psychologists have studied this, 60,000. Could you be mindful of 60,000 thoughts? No. Could you be conscious, as we're talking at the moment, Steve, to a mindful process? Perhaps not, but maybe one or two thoughts that are going through, and that's where it all starts, one or two. So, like learning golf, you take a few practice swings, and you learn how to address the ball and how to have a useful swing that drives the ball further than it did before. And that's all, you know, mindfulness is doing, is just taking you further on the road to mindful thinking. Yeah, a step at a time, one thought at a time.
So it could be simple as walking down the beach and you're observing the seashore and the birds above you and the feeling of the sun on your skin, or you're talking to your children and you're really listening to all the different aspects of what they're saying and not thinking about your work or a problem you're trying to solve, but you're very directed and focused in the things that are happening around you.
You've got it, Steve. That is exactly it. And what you're suggesting, I know, and what most people do have within them is they do have an aspect of mindfulness. When during quiet times, when they're passionate about things, when they're involved with things, when they're interested in things, reading a book, you give your full attention to it. So maybe another word for mindfulness is give full attention to an aspect of it. Things start happening. Your feelings change. Your thoughts change. You make better decisions. You become a better decision maker. You connect more with life. You find the oneness of life. All sorts of wonderful things happen. And I really, really do believe you'll become a far better employee. You'll be a far better decision maker. You'll be a far better executive if you're mindful all, you know, not all the time, but a good portion of your time, more so than you were before.
You know, from our talk here, I would probably get the sense that this is probably in your book, sort of ways that you can get into the state of having this attention to the things that you're working on or the things that you're doing.
Yes. The book is a quick survey of different aspects of life and how, from a practical point of view, you can be more mindful. The book goes through a five-step process of how you can apply, I don't like the word, but apply a technique and with practical examples. At the end of every chapter, there's a quick comment about perhaps the timeless domain, the timelessness domain, and it mentions as an example why it's important. Then it asks you to look at yourself and a series of questions of whether you are mindful of the timeless and timelessness domain. And then it tells you or arms you with practical examples how you can be more involved in the present moment and the timelessness.
So, you know, is your book directed to all generations, like Generation Y and Generation I and Baby Boomers, or are you directing this to youth?
Wow, an excellent question. You know, I've been asked that by, when I submitted my book to the publishers, the book reviewers and the editors asked me that to change my book because the title of the book is Turning the Self Inside Out, you know, a sort of self-study guide for Generation Y. And, you know, it really is for Generation Y because all my examples that I use, the scenarios of Ignatz in the book, really would occur during the post-teen years, the 20 to 34-year-old. But it's a book for everybody. The editors and the book reviewers came back and said, well, why have you, you know, just restricted this to Generation Y? Isn't it for everyone? A number of my readers have come back, and particularly the adults or the parents of Generation Y, and said, why do you say this is for Generation Y? Well, the presentations I make, the examples I use at the book, for example, relationships and dating and things such that is directed primarily for Generation Y. But, you know, it has a wide appeal. You know, and why did I do this? Why did I restrict this? Well, as I've indicated, you know, it was my teaching and volunteer work over the last 35 years. It was mostly with the little league teams and 20-year-olds, so I'm very comfortable with it. And also, you know, I during my college teaching, it was mostly with this 20-year-old group, and I spent since 1990, teaching, and presenting in industry and working with people and working with youth groups. 1990, it actually goes back to 1980. Now, I'm concerned that little is done during their school years, so perhaps my teaching, anything different about my teaching is this mindfulness aspect. And the kids, the students, actually asked me to document it. And I really think that, you know, during their professional career, there's very little done towards this mindfulness aspect. All this leads to something that I studied in the 1960s, which is self-actualization. My master's degree was in educational philosophy, and most of it had to do with self-awareness and self-actualization. So to discover who you are and appreciate something that's within you. And I really think that the thing that's within you is intelligence, not intellect, but intelligence. And I look at myself and believe I have a responsibility and a moral obligation to our future leaders, leaders of tomorrow. So again, another reason why I directed it to Generation Y. Because in my book, I forward the notion that a more peaceful and a gentler and a compassionate way of living does really exist.
So, you know, throughout this conversation, we've been talking about your book. Well, what is the major theme and purpose of your book?
Okay. Some of my writings just quite recently, I used a quote, and I'd like to apply it again. And it was from Einstein, and he said that many insoluble problems have no solution until either the paradigm or the consciousness that created the problem is changed. And I just love that. So the major theme, really, in the book is about consciousness and conscious awareness. And let me just explain a little bit here. People tend to process reality from their own sort of limited mindset. And this conscious awareness that I'm suggesting is an ability sort of to stand aside and view life and relationships through a more expansive space of a universal mindset. This awareness really is attained only when we are fully conscious of our thoughts. Again, let's get back to that mindfulness, fully conscious of our thoughts. Not as an afterthought. There's no use thinking about it afterwards, but you have to think about it during the time that the thought is happening. Now, this new mindset approach can be thought of as a paradigm shift in the self. And the book is a guide towards this self-awareness, the shifting paradigm, this new paradigm, and towards self-actualization. I'm really, really optimistic that this new mindset is a portal that affects a significant change in all our thinking, particularly the people who read the book and apply some of the concepts and all of the thought processes. And I truly believe it leads us towards a conscious way of thinking, a mindful way of thinking.
Okay, well, you got us interested and hooked. Now, can you go a little deeper and explain the this whole concept of conscious awareness and perhaps point out any benefits?
Surely. Of course, I could start off by saying, do we have 1 or 2 hours to go a little deeper? But I know that's not what you want, Stephen, so let me try and restrict it. I am often asked, what and why do I need conscious awareness? I've never thought of it before. Why should I think about it now? You know, why is it important, Richard? What's the purpose of it? Well, I argue that if you own a car, a mobile phone, or a computer, aren't you curious? Well, at least superficially, I would ask, you know, and curious about how it works. And the more that you understand about your car and your mobile phone and your computer, the more that you can take control. And conscious awareness is exactly the same thing, Stephen. It's about learning about the self, enabling you to take complete control because you are fully aware. Now, you've sort of already identified this, but let me just add it again. You know, if you're looking at a beautiful, breathtaking sunset, have you ever become immersed, delighted by it? If so, for a brief moment, all thoughts cease, and you're really captured by that moment, by the beauty that you've experienced. Now, a short time later, your thoughts return, and you lose this conscious way of thinking. You lose control, is my argument. It's almost like a car that you get in and takes you somewhere you don't want to go. My gosh, you would never want that. But yet we let our thoughts take us mindlessly to a place that we don't really want to go. So, you know, during the thoughts of this breathtaking sunset, this carefree experience of no thoughts, did you actually lose consciousness just during that time? Quite the opposite. You've really become aware of something beyond sort of your ordinary senses and your mind thoughts. Now, this idea, and it is important, gee, can I attain conscious awareness quickly? No. I have a little bit of an analogy, and it's about a train. Gee, if you were at a train crossing, and a fast-moving train was coming across that train crossing, it's a blur. So your thoughts are the same. Your thoughts are sort of a blur. You're not aware of what's happening. Now, if that train, which, you know, as it's crossing over, train crossing, slows down, you become aware that it's a passenger train. You become aware that there's people in the train. You become aware that there's children in the train, that there's people are eating in the restaurant, people are playing games on the train. You become more and more conscious, more and more aware. And that's what happens in this conscious awareness. You become more and more aware. Things slow down for you. So you see every thought sort of passing through, much like the train. The train slows down. Now, it does really seem absurd to me that we spend so much time and effort and money on our mind and our body, but precious little in which is far, far more important, our being, our spirit, or whatever you call it. And it always amazes me. Of course, I've been into this for 30, 35 years, that we do put so much effort into non-spiritual, non-being things, and the spiritual and being thing, we all agree that it's important. Now, the benefits of conscious awareness, I have quite a few that I've documented, and I think they fall under three categories, Steve. One is sort of physiological, psychological, and, of course, spiritual. And let me just think, you know, physiological, well, gee, I know in my case I've always had high blood pressure, and it certainly has done, I believe, some benefit to that. It's supposed to slow your heart rate. It does relax sort of your nervous system. Your breathing becomes more relaxed. I've found that in myself. I'm able to cure any headache or any migraine that I have. I used to have these quite regularly, and I go to a meditative process of getting rid of the headache, and it really, really works. Supposedly, too, that, you know, conscious awareness controls pain for chronic illnesses, and it certainly does reduce emotional stress. I've been through a lot this last year with three deaths in the family, and I certainly pay attention to my thoughts and my reactions and how I'm responding. And through this, I've learned to cope, and it's helped me with this emotional distress. So that's physiological. Psychologically, I know it reduces worry and fear. And my negative thoughts, I used to have all sorts of negative thoughts. We all do. They seem to be less and less because I'm aware. And as soon as I have a negative thought, it disappears because of this mindfulness. I feel I'm more creative. I can focus. I can concentrate. I can learn. I'm able to remember better. I know it improves my relationship and connectedness with people. And certainly it involves really problem solving as well. I'm able to solve problems much more easily. And I'm satisfied. Anything that I take on, I get a lot of joy and satisfaction from it, which again, I believe comes from the mindfulness process. And certainly has increased my learning skill and empathy and emotional maturity. Now, spiritual benefits, this is where I could go on and on and on, but the self-actualization is certainly important to me. It's, I believe, from a humanistic psychology point of view, it is a path towards self-actualization and inner directedness and living in the present moment. Eckhart Tolle's book on present moment, it certainly leads towards this. An experience of a sensation of oneness. I'm more aware of animals and nature and small insects, that is a oneness in life. And certainly, I guess, is that deeper self-understanding and self-awareness. And those are sort of some of the benefits that come to my mind.
So you're saying conscious awareness or this mindfulness is being aware of your thoughts or being in sort of the moment and being aware if a negative thought pops in your head and saying, hey, that's a negative thought, or being aware that you're being distracted or bringing that kind of self-look into how you're thinking. and as a result, gaining all the benefits and control, like from a physiological standpoint, psychological standpoint, from a spiritual standpoint. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying. Yes.
So is there scientific evidence that conscious awareness, this ability to kind of be mindful, that it really works?
Well, I have to be a little bit careful here. When I started a more in-depth study, Stephen, I sort of looked towards those scientific studies, limited as they are, that sort of confirmed my beliefs and my thoughts around it. So we have to be careful, because when we speak of scientific evidence, we're sort of acknowledging that there's some physical proof that exists, and there's evidence, and it can be measured and observed. But conscious awareness really is a non-physical entity. We though, in some ways, is it sort of something that we can document, we can observe, we can measure? The brain activity can be measured, and I don't think this sort of proves that it works, but we can certainly do EEG sort of testing. And it has been done on consciously aware people. For example, people who practice meditation, who are peaceful. So the scientific evidence really is restricted to some neurological effect from conscious awareness. And there is some studies being done, and it's being done at universities and in hospitals and educational institutions by quantum physicists and neuroscientists and cognitive scientists. And I'm most interested in this. I'm most interested in the proofs, because I really believe, I see myself, that it works. So I'm interested in the scientist type of approach. Now, the work being done by quantum physicists and neuroscientists and cognitive scientists, we just don't have enough detail to go into the detail. But let me summarize the findings. And again, this is where I have to be a little bit careful. And I would say that the evidence remains inconclusive. But I believe it's inconclusive because there isn't a mechanism really for measuring conscious awareness. It's just crude. We can see the brain activity, the EEG aspects, but to identify conscious awareness that it's working, am I attaining empathy? Am I attaining understanding? Am I attaining compassionate feelings? You can't really measure that. Now, there may be in the near future some, maybe brain imaging techniques that can verify this. And certainly things like EEG testing indicate that this conscious awareness does have some and significant physiological effects. I would, and because I have an interest in particular in this area because of my scientific and technology background, I do have sort of work that I've been studying, and particularly the ones that come to mind is Dr. John Hagelin, who's a quantum physicist and actually ran for the President of the United States about 12 years ago. And there is Ramesh Manaki and J.A. Dusick, just a couple of the scientists doing work on conscious awareness. And there is a couple of websites too, and I can mention those. However, a lot of the material is actually documented with the David Lynch Foundation, and David Lynch, of course, the producer, the film producer, has taken some trouble to document some of the information. He is into transcendental meditation, so a lot of his findings are biased towards transcendental meditation, but a lot is captured there. Perhaps what I would say is that, gee, if there's anyone at all, any members of your audience who would like information about these scientific studies, maybe just email me. And of course, my email is rlongw@telus.net, and I'd certainly give them the sites and more detailed studies of what I found.
Do you believe there's a clash between science and spirituality?
Wow, what a question. And, technology and science and spirituality is certainly the last 2 or 3 years in particular. I've spent an awful lot of time on. I really think that science and spirituality, they both search for truth. We're trying to find out the truth of spirituality. As few as they are, we try and identify them. Now, the digression really occurs since science searches for truth in the physical world, and spirituality seeks really truth in nature, of non-physical, of consciousness. So in this difference, Stephen, there is no conflict between the two. They're looking at the world in a different paradigm, in a different reality. The scientific paradigm, presently does not include consciousness or conscious awareness in its realm of study. But maybe when science truly explores the inner realm of the mind, it will make this paradigm leap and add a new worldview, and one that includes spiritual being. But at the moment, it doesn't. So, there is no really separation, and there is no clash. It's just that one does not study the other or support the other.
You know, we've talked about a lot of things, and I'm just sensing that maybe the audience may have trouble grasping some of these concepts, and especially for technical people, because they're very sort of into, drilling deep.
Of course, yes.
And getting into the nitty-gritty. Can you give the audience a practical example?
Yeah, and, certainly that appeals, and I understand that, is that from a technology point of view, we sort of go at a deeper level, and maybe this is why I'm looking at the scientific studies and looking at the research, even though I know it's happening with myself. But so your question really is some sort of a practical example from the book, and perhaps not an ideal one, but the one that many of my readers, my Generation Y readers, keep coming back to and saying, gee, how can I, and where do I start applying a conscious awareness? And I have a simple example in the book, and it's during the times that we perform repetitive tasks. Now, this could be out in the garden. It could be, going for a walk, taking the bus, maybe relaxing at work, washing the dishes, doing the vacuuming, all repetitive tasks. And here's one example, and I call it the washing the dishes scenario, repetitive task. Now, while washing the dishes, I've suggested in my book, initiate a mantra, a repetitive thing that you're going to say. And the one I suggest is, repeat the mantra, here I am washing the dishes. Now, why am I suggesting that? Well, if you wash the dishes, because it's a repetitive task, if you just listen to your thoughts, they're all over the place. If you repeat the mantra, it's called one-pointedness. It points you to one thing. And the one thing it's pointing to is repeating the mantra, and not letting any other thoughts come into your mind. I suggest you have to repeat it calmly and gently while working on the task, and at the same time be fully aware of the water that's running from the tap, the soap suds sparkling in the basin, the smell of the soapy water. You can see what's happening. You become attuned. As soon as you remove the thought process, you become attuned to nature, the connectedness, the oneness, other aspects of life, the important aspects of life. So the purpose really is to concentrate on the present moment. And the reason really for the mantra is to stay grounded without letting your mind wander. Very quickly what happens, this is what the students and my Generation Y was saying, gee, relaxation, I feel relaxed. I'm more aware. Gee, the birds outside, I can hear them. I never realized they were singing when I was washing the dishes. Wow, the chatter and noise of the children in the playground, I was never aware of that. So you become certainly far more aware. And outside worries and events that happen during the day, they lose their perspective. They disappear. They dissipate. They actually are removed from your consciousness, your conscious being. So all the things that happen at work, all the things that happen, the worries, the fears that you have disappear. And I suggest that this technique, this is just one example, it should be applied really to all repetitive tasks on a regular basis. Even just doing that, Stephen, is a remarkable transformation that starts taking place in your being, not in your doing, but in your being.
I see. So I'm just thinking Generation Y, they may not be washing the dishes that much. But
that's a good point, yes. But in the case where the feedback I did receive, I guess these were married couples or married people who were, maybe didn't even have a dishwasher at the time.
Or it could be taking a shower, because I think everybody takes a shower.
Wonderful. Yes, that's a very good example.
And they tend to daydream while they're taking the shower. So rather than thinking about problems at work or problems at school or assignments or for an older person, specifically problems at work or problems in the relationship, they can be saying, I am taking a shower. And think
Excellent.
About the water coming cascading over you and the soap bubbles and whatever, right?
So
that's what you're talking about.
The suggestion is when I write the second book, the shower is certainly a better example for Generation Y, for everybody. No, I agree.
And And especially if you have a shower with a window, and you can maybe perhaps hear outside, and then you can maybe take a look as well.
Exactly. Perfect. And just adds more to these practical examples from the book and the repetitive task, as you're suggesting.
You know, I guess this is would be a great asset for IT people because they tend to get lost in thought, specifically with problems that are nagging them, right? And
Yes. They
need a point of relaxation or a point of getting out of that, always thinking about problems or things that have gone wrong in the past or potential problems that are coming up, and they're always worrying and anxiety. And this would be a great mechanism sort of getting rid of that anxiety, out of that worry by being in the moment.
You know, I think perhaps people who are into recreational and exercise always say that that must be part of your regime, and it will add much more to your life. And the same thing with conscious awareness is exercise for the mind rather than exercise for the body. And the studies have indicated that you solve problems better, you don't worry as much, you become more creative, more purposeful, the decision-making process is much better. Gee, you know, and it's just about taking time to do this balanced type of life. You know, I'm not saying that you should spend all your time on spirituality or conscious awareness. Gee, you have to read, you have to exercise. Take yourself away, and as you say, IT people get very immersed in their work.
I also know that a lot of IT people go out for jogs, and I always see them with the earbuds in their, you know, because they're listening to an iPod. But again, they're being distracted, right?
Yes.
So rather than that, they should be thinking about, I am jogging. I can sense the pavement. I can see the trees around me. I can hear the birds, et cetera, et cetera. Right?
And I can see the reaction towards that is that, but, you know, I'm into my iPod. I'm into my music. I just love, whatever they're doing, not being. But and I can understand that part of it. And I'm not suggesting that they have to give up that. I'm just saying that there's another part of life, perhaps that you haven't looked at. And maybe just through conscious awareness, you can be aware of it and see what it has to offer. I feel it offers an awful lot that people are missing. But we don't sort of instill it. So, again, my purpose at the moment is perhaps to promote it and instill it. There was something different out there, something you should look at.
So what are your future plans related to your book and your teachings?
Well, I suppose I'm now convinced that conscious awareness has taken some sort of root, and particularly with the work with Judy Krishnamurti and recently with Eckhart Tolle and, of course, people like Oprah. And it is taking root in the Western world, in North America. It seems to have a foundation that we can build on. I do believe, though, that there's urgent need for a change in global consciousness, I will call it, not individual or localized consciousness, but global consciousness, as we discussed today. And one approach that could accelerate significantly the process is through the application of technology and particular networking. So, you know, the question is, what are my future plans? Well, last year I did presentations. I did conferences and group presentations, but the numbers really were relatively small. So this critical mass, this taking root, I think it was offering very little. And now with my technology background, I've really moved to a new paradigm of conscious awareness. I've moved it up a notch, and I believe now I'm positioned really to promote global consciousness. So one approach is by connecting with like-minded individuals, and recently I opened a Twitter account. Wow, you know, I have, after 2 weeks, 500 followers, like-minded people who are into spirituality, meditation, and education. You know, that's how I created the account. I often go to my accounts and see, you know, the hangers-on who are not there, but I think I've got, you know, after a few weeks, 500 good followers. I use Meeting Up for interactive group discussions, so if we do have a meeting. I've only just started trying this. I want a group of Generation Y people and Generation X people to help me, you know, sort of further some of my concepts, but give me advice. And we have group discussions through Meeting Up. Now, I plan to form a core group of individuals that sort of can add value to the concepts and the ideas in my books. And I'm sending out sort of questionnaires and surveys to provide and identify that direction. And I'm sort of asking individuals, if on either a volunteer basis or a personal basis, whether or not they could do something towards this conscious awareness movement. And I'm hoping, you know, additional conferences and podcasts like the one today. I hope there's more opportunity to do those. Hoping maybe a member of your audience has an idea or a thought or something that they would like to suggest. I encourage that. I'm looking at Second Life too, Stephen. It's an option to present the seminars and sort of town hall meetings. You know, going out and talking to 20 or 30 people, it's important. And it's important that you affect one person. But I realize that global awareness won't take root unless we get the critical mass and unless we get the numbers. So I'm thinking of presenting courses or seminars maybe in Second Life. Now, this is just, I haven't done anything about that at the moment, but I've certainly looked at Second Life as an option. Now, at all times, I try and make my writings and discussions relevant for the times, and I'll keep doing that. I'll keep writing. I'll keep encouraging people to look at education, look at technology, look at the scientific aspects, look at science versus spirituality, look at quantum physics. All these are relevant types of topics for the times. And I ask, too, if any members of the audience has other ideas, I certainly would be pleased to hear from them.
So how about YouTube?
An aspect of my future plan.
So how about YouTube? Have you any plans for something like that?
Yeah, of course. Certainly that has crossed my mind. It's just that I have not attempted that yet. It's certainly a generation Y, or maybe everybody is into YouTube. Certainly an excellent idea. So let me add that to my list. Yes, yeah, YouTube is an excellent way of going.
Well, you know, we covered a lot of areas in this interview. Now I'm going to turn the tables. What questions would you ask, and then what would be your answers if you were doing the interview?
Well, that's probably the most difficult question, Stephen. Now, I think because all your questions were excellent, and you've left really no stone unturned. But let me ramble a bit, and I'll try and address some of the questions. So, you know, the last thing that you ask is, what are your future plans? So maybe one question that comes to mind is, what are my current interests? Where am I at the moment? And, you know, I'm into living in the present moment, so perhaps this is a good question to piggyback on. You know, I'm retired and have a choice to pursue what I want when I want. It's wonderful. It's a great time in your life. I'm enjoying the freedom to choose without obligation, a commitment of, you know, I'm not really having to worry about the end result or reaching a particular end result. And I truly believe I'm immersed wholly in the process and just seeing where it leads. So sort of the moment by moment type of thing. Now, just quite recently, and there was a wedding, my daughter's wedding in Boston. So I developed an interest after the wedding in photography and videography. We had, you know, 1,000 pictures and we had 4 hours of video. So I've now been spending quite a bit of time just recently on editing software. As it comes, you know, the present moment as it appears, I take on things of interest. Now, I realize that I don't have time constraints. I can explore different avenues. I can tailor my photography needs, for example. But, you know, with my work in conscious awareness, I'd like to write a second book. There's maybe something else. This is more towards the future, but there's a current interest in that. But, you know, whether my interest is in photography or writing or whatever, or music, I don't feel the pressure of having to do. And I think this is important. I can simply now be, and I'd like to certainly leave that one aspect, is that, you know, don't have to worry about the doing. I just can simply be. So one of my thoughts on one of my suggestions after I retired is that instead of being at work, I'm now working on my being. Now, let's think the second question, and maybe this is a little bit of a marketing thing, but certainly as we, you know, asking these questions, I'd like to suggest how best can the audience or individuals connect with my work. So if any members of the audience or anybody who's interested in what I'm doing, it's best to connect me through me, really, through my Twitter account, @RLongW, because that's where I tell them what I'm doing on a day-to-day basis and what I'm writing and what I'm promoting and what I'm suggesting. And otherwise, though, if you want to write to me at more lengthy email, certainly RLongW@telus.net. Twitter, of course, is restricted to 140 characters, but certainly if you want to go on a little longer and ask me, or contact me, RLongW@telus.net. Now, and you asked for a third question. Well, I guess the third question really would be, what are my final words? And this is geared, I suppose, because of this interview more towards the IT professional and the future leaders of tomorrow, Generation Y, etc. In North America, you know, each one of us really have an opportunity to do and become the best we can be. There's unlimited opportunities for each and every one of us. I firmly believe we can sort of capitalize on these unlimited opportunities, but what we achieve really is a direct result of our attitude, and I'll emphasize this word, is our attitude, the right state of being. And this really does make all the difference in the world. It makes life worth living from moment to moment, from day to day. You know, our feelings and actions and responses really come from within, and they all start from this, again, conscious spot that we've talked about, Stephen. Now, I ask the audience, I ask the individual, I ask people that I speak to, are you aware of your thoughts? Are you aware of this? You really should be. How, you know, how wonderful really to be with people, and we meet them every day who are upbeat and passionate and understanding and compassionate. And I ask, as a, you know, a final thought lecture, let your thinking process, let your thoughts sort of dance with this idea. It's so important that you with people who are upbeat and passionate and understanding. Wouldn't it be nice if you were that? So if these attributes and other positive attributes are truly what you want to be, then through your thoughts, through this paradigm shift, you really will create this desired outcome, all through conscious awareness.
Well, Richard, that's you give us some great sort of tips and questions and answers and a lot of food for thought and mindfulness, that's for sure. You know, we are indeed fortunate to have you come in and do this interview with us today. So thank you for sharing your substantial wisdom and deep insights with our audience.
And thank you, Stephen, for a wonderful, wonderful opportunity. And certainly if anybody wants to get in touch with me and has the opportunity to arrive, I'd love to speak. I'll be part of their life as well.
I'm Steve Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Richard Longworth, leading award-winning international technology authority, thought leader, educator, and celebrated author.